Chapter 9. Was perfectly able to do, the man actually struck out for a small rock 100 yards away, and was frantically trying to climb up its perpendicular side. The tide being out, to jump into the horrible mud under the houses would have been almost certain death. Nothing remained therefore since the miserable dwelling would not have withstood a vigorous kick, let alone a siege, but to rush back on shore and regain possession of the boat. To this Lingard made up his mind quickly, and, arming himself with a crooked stick he found under his hand, sallied forth at the head of his three men. As he bounded along, far in advance, he had just time to perceive clearly the desperate nature of the undertaking, when he heard two shots fired to his right. The solid mass of black bodies and frizzly heads in front of him wavered and broke up. They did not run away, however. Lingard pursued his course, but now with that thrill of exultation which even a faint prospect of success inspires in a sanguine man. He heard a shout of many voices far off, then there was another report of a shot, and a musket ball fired at long range spurted a tiny jet of sand between him and his wild enemies. His next bound would have carried him into their midst had they awaited his onset, but his uplifted arm found nothing to strike. Black backs were leaping high or gliding horizontally through the grass toward the edge of the bush. He flung his stick at the nearest pair of black shoulders and stopped short. The tall grasses swayed themselves into a rest, a chorus of yells and piercing shrieks died out in a dismal howl, and all at once the wooded shores and the blue bay seemed to fall under the spell of a luminous stillness. The change was as startling as the awakening from a dream. The sudden silence struck Lingard as amazing. He broke it by lifting his voice in a stentorian shout, which arrested the pursuit of his men. They retired reluctantly, glaring back angrily at the wall of a jungle, where not a single leaf stirred. The strangers, whose opportune appearance had decided the issue of that adventure, did not attempt to join in the pursuit, but halted in a compact body on the ground lately occupied by the savages. Lingard and the young leader of the Wajo traders met in the splendid light of noonday, and amidst the attentive silence of their followers, on the very spot where the Malay seaman had lost his life. Lingard, striding up from one side, thrust out his open palm. Hassam responded at once to the frank gesture, and they exchanged their first hand clasp over the prostrate body, as if fate had already exacted the price of a death for the most ominous of her gifts, the gift of friendship, that sometimes contains the whole good or evil of a life. "I'll never forget this day," cried Lingard in a hearty tone, and the other smiled quietly. Then after a short pause, "Will you burn the village for vengeance?" asked the Malay with a quick glance down at the dead Lascar who, on his face, and with stretched arms, seemed to cling desperately to that earth, of which he had known so little. Lingard hesitated. "No," he said, at last. "It would do good to no one." "True," said Hassam, gently, "but was this man near dead or a slave?"
"Slave?"
cried Lingard. "This is an English brig."
"Slave?"
"No. A free man like myself."
"Hi.
He is indeed free now," muttered the Malay with another glance downward. "Be but who will pay the bereaved for his life? If there is anywhere a woman or child belonging to him, I myself would know. I shall seek them out," cried Lingard, remorsefully.
"You speak like a chief," said Hassam, "only our great men do not go to battle with naked hands.
Oh, you white men. Oh, the valor of you white men."
"It was folly, pure folly," protested Lingard, "and this poor fellow has paid for it."
"He could not avoid his destiny," murmured the Malay. "It is in my mind my trading is finished now in this place," he added, cheerfully. Lingard expressed his regret.
"It is no matter, it is no matter," assured the other courteously, and after Lingard had given a pressing invitation for Hassam and his two companions of high rank to visit the brig, the two parties separated. The evening was calm when the Malay craft left its berth near the shore and was rowed slowly across the bay to Lingard's anchorage. The end of a stout line was thrown on board, and that night the white man's brig and the brown man's prow swung together to the same anchor. The sun setting to seaward shot its last rays between the headlands, when the body of the killed Lascar, wrapped up decently in a white sheet, according to Mohammedan usage, was lowered gently below the still waters of the bay upon which his curious glances, only a few hours before, had rested for the first time. At the moment the dead man, released from slip ropes, disappeared without a ripple before the eyes of his shipmates, the bright flash and the heavy report of the brig's bow gun were succeeded by the muttering echoes of the encircling shores, and by the loud cries of seabirds that, wheeling in clouds, seemed to scream after the departing seaman a wild and eternal goodbye. The master of the brig, making his way aft with hanging head, was followed by low murmurs of pleased surprise from his crew as well as from the strangers who crowded the main deck. In such acts performed simply, from conviction, what may be called the romantic side of the man's nature came out, that responsive sensitiveness to the shadowy appeals made by life and death, which is the groundwork of a chivalrous character. Lingard entertained his three visitors far into the night. A sheep from the brig sea stock was given to the men of the prow, while in the cabin, Hassam and his two friends, sitting in a row on the stern settee, looked very splendid with costly medals and flawed jewels. The talk conducted with hearty friendship on Lingard's part, and on the part of the Malays with the well-bred air of discreet courtesy, which is natural to the better class of that people, touched upon many subjects, and, in the end, drifted to politics. "It is in my mind that you are a powerful man in your own country," said Hassam, with a circular glance at the cuddy. "My country is upon a faraway sea, where the light breezes are as strong as the winds of the rainy weather here," said Lingard, and there were low exclamations of wonder. I left it very young, and I don't know about my power there, where great men alone are as numerous as the poor people in all your islands, to an Hassam. But here," he continued, "here, which is also my country being an English craft and worthy of it, too I am powerful enough. In fact, I am Raja here. This bit of my country is all my own." The visitors were impressed, exchanged meaning glances, nodded at each other. "Good, good," said Hassam at last, with a smile. "Why you carry your country and your power with you over the sea? A Raja upon the sea. Good." Lingard laughed thunderously, while the others looked amused. "Your country is very powerful, we know," began again Hassam after a pause, "but is it stronger than the country of the Dutch who steal our land?" "Stronger?" cried Lingard. He opened a broad palm. "Stronger? We could take them in our hand like this," and he closed his fingers triumphantly. "And do you make them pay tribute for their land?" inquired Hassam with eagerness. "No," answered Lingard in a sobered tone. "This, to an Hassam, you see, is not the custom of white men. We could, of course, but it is not the custom." "Is it not?" said the other with a skeptical smile. "They are stronger than we are, and they want tribute from us. And sometimes they get it even from Wajo, where every man is free, and wears a kris." There was a period of dead silence, while Lingard looked thoughtful and the Malays gazed stonily at nothing. "But we burn our powder amongst ourselves," went on Hassam, gently, "and blunt our weapons upon one another." He sighed, paused, and then changing to an easy tone, began to urge Lingard to visit Wajo or trade, and to see friends, he said, laying his hand on his breast and inclining his body slightly. "Aye, to trade with friends," cried Lingard with a laugh, "for such a ship," he waved his arm, "or such a vessel as this is like a household, where there are many behind the curtain. It is as costly as a wife and children." The guests rose, and took their leave. "You fired three shots for me, Panglima Hassam," said Lingard, "seriously, and I have had three barrels of powder put on board your prow, one for each shot. But we are not quits." The Malay's eyes glittered with pleasure. "This is indeed a friend's gift. Come to see me in my country." "I promise," said Lingard, to see you someday. The calm surface of the bay reflected the glorious night sky, and the brig with the prow riding astern seemed to be suspended amongst the stars, in a peace that was almost unearthly in the perfection of its unstirring silence. The last handshakes were exchanged on deck, and the Malays went aboard their own craft. Next morning, when a breeze sprang up soon after sunrise, the brig and the prow left the bay together. When clear of the land, Lingard made all sail, and sheered alongside to say goodbye before parting company the brig, of course, sailing 3 feet to the prow's one. Hassam stood on the high deck aft. "Prosperous road," hailed Lingard. "Remember the promise," shouted the other, "and come soon," he went on, raising his voice as the brig forged past. "See, come soon, lest what perhaps is written should come to pass." The brig shot ahead. "What?" yelled Lingard in a puzzled tone. "What's written?" He listened. And floating over the water, came faintly the words, "No one knows." "Three, my word." "I couldn't help liking the chap," would shout Lingard when telling the story, and looking around at the eyes that glittered at him through the smoke of cheroots. "This Brixham trawler boy, afterward a youth in Collier's, deep water man, gold digger, owner and commander of the finest brig afloat, knew that by his listeners seamen, traders, adventurers like himself this was accepted not as the expression of a feeling, but as the highest commendation he could give his Malay friend. By heavens, I shall go to Wajo," he cried, and a semicircle of heads nodded grave approbation, while a slightly ironical voice said deliberately, "You are a made man, Tom, if you get on the right side of that Raja of yours." "Go in and look out for yourself," cried another with a laugh. A little professional jealousy was unavoidable. Wajo, on account of its chronic state of disturbance, being close to the white traders. But there was no real ill will in the banter of these men, who, rising with handshakes, dropped off one by one. Lingard went straight aboard his vessel, and, till morning, walked the poop of the brig with measured steps. The riding lights of ships twinkled all around him. The lights ashore twinkled in rows, the stars twinkled above his head in a black sky, and reflected in the black water of the roadstead twinkled far below his feet. And all these innumerable and shining points were utterly lost in the immense darkness. Once he heard faintly the rumbling chain of some vessel coming to an anchor far away somewhere outside the official limits of the harbor. A stranger to the port, thought Lingard, one of us would have stood right in. Perhaps a ship from home? And he felt strangely touched at the thought of that ship, weary with months of wandering, and daring not to approach the place of rest. At sunrise, while the big ship from the west, her sides streaked with rust and gray with the salt of the sea, was moving slowly in to take up a berth near the shore, Lingard left the roadstead on his way to the eastward. A heavy gulf thunderstorm was raging, when after a long passage, and at the end of a sultry calm day, wasted in drifting helplessly in sight of his destination, Lingard, taking advantage of fitful gusts of wind, approached the shores of Wajo. With characteristic audacity, he held on his way, closing in with a coast to which he was a stranger, and on a night that would have appalled any other man. While at every dazzling flash, Hassam's native land seemed to leap nearer at the brig, and disappear instantly, as though it had crouched low for the next spring out of an impenetrable darkness. During the long day of the calm, he had obtained from the deck and from aloft such good views of the coast, and had noted the lay of the land, and the position of the danger so carefully that, though at the precise moment when he gave the order to let go the anchor, he had been for some time able to see no further than if his head had been wrapped in a woolen blanket, yet the next flickering bluish flash showed him the brig, anchored almost exactly where he had judged her to be, off a narrow white beach near the mouth of a river. He could see on the shore a high cluster of bamboo huts perched upon piles, a small grove of tall palms all bowed together before the blast-like stalks of grass, something that might have been a palisade of pointed stakes near the water, and far off, a somber background resembling an immense wall of forest-clad hills. Next moment, all this vanished utterly from his sight, as if annihilated, and, before he had time to turn away, came back to view with a sudden crash, appearing unscathed and motionless under hooked darts of flame, like some legendary country of immortals, withstanding the wrath and fire of heaven. Made uneasy by the nature of his holding ground, and fearing that in one of the terrific offshore gusts the brig would start her anchor, Lingard remained on deck, to watch over the safety of his vessel. With one hand upon the lead line which would give him instant warning of the brig beginning to drag, he stood by the rail, most of the time deafened and blinded, but also fascinated, by the repeated swift visions of an unknown shore, a sight always. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.